You're listening to the Already Gone podcast, sharing stories of the missing, the murdered, the mysterious, and the lost. Do you remember 1976? I shouldn't remember it, but I do, at least parts of it. I was living with my grandparents in suburban Detroit. To celebrate the bicentennial, all of the fire hydrants in the neighborhood had been painted to look like characters from the Revolutionary War. My grandfather, a history professor, showed me each one and explained who they were and their role in the American Revolution. This was also the year that the Concorde, a supersonic jet, took flight, and if you lived in Pennsylvania, maybe you celebrated the Steelers' Super Bowl win in January. At the Brannigan household in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, 1976 was a difficult year. This is the year that Peg Brannigan, wife of Dick and mother of Sean and Holly, lost her battle with leukemia. She'd been sick for quite a while, but her family was devastated. Holly took things in stride. She did the best she could to fill the role of lady of the house. Her father, a sales rep for a cement company, did his best to keep things normal for the kids and provide stability. In 1979, Holly was 17, a senior in high school. She was dark-haired and pretty, taking on a lot of responsibility at home, but balancing that with her friendships, and she was active in the school choir and managed the soccer team. She also worked part-time. Holly was a good student, not exceptional, but good enough for college. Like other girls her age, she dated and planned for her future. Holly and many of her friends had seen John Carpenter's groundbreaking horror film, Halloween. Moviegoers were frightened by a new boogeyman, a knife-wielding maniac named Michael Myers. With its creepy theme music and familiar neighborhood setting, the movie was wildly popular and provided thrills for audiences. Little did she know, her life was going to take a very dark turn, like something out of the horror movie Holly watched with her friends. Before we delve into Holly's story, I want to tell you about this week's sponsor, Blue Apron. My family loves a good meal, but with our busy schedules, it's a challenge to shop, prep, and cook up something delicious and rewarding for dinner each night. Then I found Blue Apron. Their mission is to make incredible home-cooked meals accessible to everyone. For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked dinners. Meals with flavorful, fresh ingredients like seared chicken with brown rice and glazed purple carrots. Check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/alreadygone. You can customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. Blue Apron is delicious, convenient, and so easy to use. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. That's blueapron.com/alreadygone. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. March 28th, 1979 wasn't just any day, especially if you lived in Pennsylvania. In the early morning hours of March 28th, the worst accident in the history of U.S. nuclear energy began. The Three Mile Island Nuclear Power Plant was built in 1974 in the middle of Pennsylvania's Susquehanna River, just 10 miles downstream from the state capital in Harrisburg. In 1978, a second reactor began operating on Three Mile Island. This was an exciting development, and nuclear energy was viewed as clean, safe, and modern. It was in the wee hours of that Wednesday morning when things started to go wrong at the plant. Instead of maximizing cooling, operators shut down the emergency cooling pumps that should have kept the reactor from heating to dangerous, life-threatening levels. Instead, they were confused by the reports and the chaos of the situation. They deactivated the emergency backups. By 8 a.m., just a few hours after the primary cooling system had a failure, most of the United States was aware that there was a very grim situation unfolding in Pennsylvania. Without cooling protocols in place, the temperature of the core began to climb, reaching dangerously high numbers. Meltdown occurs at 5,000 degrees, and by 6 p.m. that night, temperatures were hovering above 4,000 degrees. By 8 o'clock, the plant's operation team realized the cooling system wasn't functioning, and they restored it. This brought the temperature down and returned it to a normal range. A catastrophic meltdown was narrowly avoided, but the core was damaged. Additional damage would be discovered in the days following the incident. United States President Jimmy Carter visited the plant on April 1st. And I didn't realize that President Carter was a trained nuclear engineer and had worked on a reactor in Canada while serving in the military. Carter's presence at the site helped calm the fears of local residents. However, nothing Carter or other nuclear engineers could say or do would restore America's trust in nuclear energy. Three Mile Island was shut down until the mid-1980s, and there would not be another nuclear plant built in the United States after the events at Three Mile Island. Meanwhile, 100 miles east of the chaos at Three Mile Island, Holly Brannigan's day started out like any other. Holly went to school, attended classes, saw her friends, and took the bus home. Her brother, Sean, didn't come home that evening. He was at a friend's house. This left Holly alone at the Brannigan home, a modern multi-level house located in a wooded neighborhood just southeast of Lehigh Valley Thruway. The neighborhood was a series of large houses on winding, tree-lined streets. When Holly got home, she attended to Clancy, the family dog, called some friends, and started getting ready for her evening. She had plans to go out with her friends and grab a pizza at 6 p.m. Because Sean had taken the car that day, Holly relied on her friend for a ride to go get that pizza. Later in the afternoon, Holly is in her bedroom. She's on the phone with a friend. We'll call her Sherry. When there's a knock at the door, Holly tells Sherry, "Hold on a minute," and sets the extension down in her room. A moment later, she picks up another phone and tells Sherry, "Someone's here. I will call you back." It's 4:40 p.m. At 4:45, Holly calls her father's office and speaks with his secretary. She asks if her father has left for his business trip yet. The secretary, and we'll call her B, confirms that yes, Richard Brannigan has left to attend a business convention. Holly thanks her and hangs up. B doesn't notice any distress or anxiety in Holly's voice. At 5 o'clock, Sherry calls Holly back. The phone rings and rings. It's 1979. There's no voicemail, and most people don't yet have answering machines. At 6 p.m., her friend arrives to pick Holly up. Remember, they have plans to go get pizza. She knocks at the door, but there's no answer. Figuring Holly forgot and made other plans, she gets back in her car and drives away. That evening, Sean calls the house a couple of times. He wants to let Holly know that he's going to stay at his friend Bobby's house that night. Bobby's parents made dinner for the boys, and they're working on a car. But Sean isn't able to reach his little sister. In the morning, another friend, we'll call her Pam, arrives to take Holly to school. Again, there's no answer, but she sees the family dog. Thinking that Holly might be in the shower or running late, she waits and knocks again, but there's only Clancy. Pam walks to the side of the house and considers climbing the stairs to the upper level, where the kitchen is located, so she can peer in the window, but she does not. Pam will later tell investigators that she had a bad feeling, so rather than walking up the stairs and looking in the kitchen window, she gets back in her car and drives away. Holly doesn't show up for school, and later that morning, Sean comes home and finds a scene from a horror film. Except this is real. His sister is dead on the floor in the kitchen. She's been stabbed more than a dozen times. The knife is still in her body, the handle broken off and laying nearby. The kitchen shows signs of a struggle. One report says that a clock is laying on the floor, broken, the time frozen at 5:20 p.m. If you remember, Holly's phone calls. That was around 4:40 when she said that someone was at the door, and 4:45 when she called her father's office and spoke to the secretary. This is 1979. Crime scene investigation, especially in a town like Bethlehem, where murders are infrequent, doesn't involve strict protocols. There are no gloves or shoe covers. The room isn't cordoned off with limited access to the scene. There are perhaps as many as a dozen people who move through the kitchen of the Brannigan home that morning. There are about 24 photos taken of the murder scene, If the photos are instant, perhaps from a Polaroid camera, film is expensive and hopefully you brought enough of it with you. If the pictures are taken with a 35mm camera, I hope you have enough film and you need to budget for getting the photos developed. So, this is not the ideal scenario for evidence preservation and collection. Bethlehem police do their best to collect what's there. One piece of evidence that I've read about in various online forums is that a towel with bloodstains was collected at the scene. Does this towel really exist? Has it been checked for DNA? Whoever stabbed Holly had to have injured themselves in the process. The knife that she was killed with was a kitchen knife, something grabbed in the heat of the moment. When the medical examiner looks at Holly's body, they count 15 stab wounds. Any one of them would have been fatal. There are 3 additional wounds that are less serious, and Holly's hands show defensive wounds. When the crime lab looks at the knife, the handle is wiped clean of prints. Police discover the phone in Holly's bedroom is off the hook, which explains why Sean couldn't get a call through to the house the night before. In case you're thinking about how convenient it is that Sean wasn't home that night, Sean has a strong alibi in the parents of the friend he was staying with. Sean was at their home the entire night. Investigators worked hard collecting evidence. Holly's nails were clipped, and more than a dozen fingerprints were taken from the scene. There is one print taken from the kitchen that detectives feel is promising, but the print is not good enough to be entered into APHIS. Holly's clothing is collected, bagged, and placed into evidence. Police interviewed many of Holly's friends and classmates. Unfortunately, some of the students were barred from being interviewed. Their parents refused to allow them to talk to police. If they were under 18, parents had the right to do that. If they were over 18, lawyers were hired to shield their children from involvement in the case. Now, almost 40 years later, these students are adults with children of their own. They could cooperate with the police if they chose. Her 2 close friends, Pam and Sherry, both cooperated with police at the time. As the years have passed, they appear to be reluctant to talk to investigators. The case is more than 35 years old. It's something that happened when they were teenagers, kids really, and this case has followed them into their 50s. Whoever killed Holly had to be spattered with blood and more than likely had wounds on their hands. The 10-inch kitchen knife used to murder Holly did not have a guard at the end of the handle. Sadly, DNA testing was unheard of in 1979. Blood may not have been collected, and if the weapon was tested, it's likely contaminated. Oh, and that 10-inch knife? The murder weapon was sticking out of Holly's back when her brother discovered her body on March 29th. It was wielded with such force and intensity that the blade of the knife snapped. Her killer wiped the handle clean and left it in the kitchen with Holly's body. Police notified Dick Branigan, and he returns from Atlantic City, New Jersey, and the conference he'd been at. W. Richard Branigan is an Army veteran who was a lieutenant in the Army Air Corps, but losing his wife and then his daughter, it would bring anyone to their knees. He and Sean grieve. They plan another funeral, and they say another tearful goodbye.
They found the victim laying on the kitchen floor with a large kitchen knife sticking out of her right back area.
Police believe Holly knew her killer. They have the murder weapon, but no fingerprints, and there was no sign of a robbery or sexual assault.
Police investigated and worked the case, but there wasn't a suspect. There was no arrest. Articles in the paper dried up. The community moved on. Hoping to out the killer, Sean tells people that he knows who killed Holly, and the police are closing in. His father cautions him not to do this. Sean could draw the wrath of the murderer on himself. Meanwhile, Bethlehem police are stumped. A good suspect hasn't emerged. Sherry, who was on the phone with Holly around 4:30 the day she was murdered, cannot recall much about the last part of their phone call. She heard a radio on in the background, but can't remember what was playing. She heard another voice when Holly picked up the extension and said she would call back, but can't remember if the voice was that of a man or a woman. Police, scrambling for results, call in the amazing Kreskin. Yes, that's right. The amazing Kreskin. Kreskin, born George Kresge, was a mentalist. He had his own television show from 1970 to 1975, The Amazing World of Kreskin. He doesn't consider himself a magician or a psychic, but uses hypnotic techniques to improve memory and recall in those he works with. Kreskin also worked with law enforcement groups to help them use relaxation techniques to spur people's memories and recall details. He worked with the ear witness, Sherry, and was able to determine what songs were on the radio during their phone call. They contacted local radio stations to learn what time those songs were played and pinned down a precise time that Holly responded to a knock at the door of her home. This allowed law enforcement to determine that when Pam arrived to pick Holly up for their pizza outing, the killer had either just left or was possibly still in the house cleaning up after the attack.
Ladies and gentlemen, the amazing Kreskin.
Sometimes I really get the feeling, folks, that we've done this before, but that's because, of course, we're in the...
The Brannigan family isn't safe. There are terrible things waiting for them. Holly's brother has only a few months to live. Was his father right? Did Sean's comments about knowing who killed his sister cost him his life? Or was his death a tragic and preventable accident? Thank you for listening to this episode of the Already Gone podcast. Next week, we will continue covering Holly Brannigan's murder and the shocking after effects of this still unresolved case. Please check out our November sponsor, Blue Apron. If you haven't tried Blue Apron, I hope you'll take advantage of the special offer and support this show. Plus, you get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/alreadygone. You can also support the show by subscribing on iTunes or your favorite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. This helps others discover the show and the cases covered here. Thank you to Sugarbird Holiday, what a happy name, for the 5-star review. For this episode, I was able to talk with people close to the investigation, including photojournalist Jim Friedman, who has followed Holly's case for years. As always, thank you to Luke Superior. He creates the music you hear each week. Find Luke on SoundCloud. And thanks to you, the listeners. And please, be safe.